Well, let me start like everybody else and start by thanking the organizers for giving me the opportunity to participate in this workshop. When I saw the program and the people participating, I was expecting to hear interesting talks and learn a lot of things, and I have certainly not been disappointed. And actually, I would like to thank the participants too for sharing their knowledge with me, listening to my questions, and helping me out. So, for those of you to whom I have asked questions that I haven't answered yet, you have 24 hours to give me a complete and circumcised. So, let me start with my talk. Let me first see if I, yes. So this is an introductory slide that I use whenever I give talks about these kinds of problems, and that's not really needed here, but you can read it while I talk. The problem I'll talk about is one of open systems theory, I like to call it. The term that hasn't been used here very much, but you have a system with a small number of degrees of freedom. Here it will be a particle interacting with some bath which has many degrees of freedom. And I will be interested a little differently from most talks here in just the behavior of the particle rather than of a big chunk of the bath, as has mostly been the case here. So this is work. The specific models I'll look at are the models we ended up baptizing dynamical Lorentz gases. I'll be a bit more specific in a second. But you could, for example, think of them as the rotor models that we have heard about, where you replace each of these rotors by an oscillator, and then you have a system of the type that I will be describing. And I've worked over the years on this, over the last few years, with various collaborators that are listed there, and we looked in particular about on questions of transport and Ohm's law. And I'll just sort of make one statement. I will not talk about that part of the work. I'll talk about the last part, which is approach to equilibrium of the particle momentum distribution. But let me just say one sentence to see if you agree. You can come and tell me afterwards you don't. But we have, with Laurent Bruno, we studied one of these systems which are completely Hamiltonian and proved Ohm's law holds for it. And I think that this today still the only fully Hamiltonian system for which anybody has proven Ohm's law. But of course, it's a very, very simple system. And so you can ask me about it later if you want. So, let's have a quick look at what the Lorentz gas is. So we've seen it several times, of course. The Lorentz gas, I call it inert here for the discussion I'm having here today, to make it different from, to distinguish it from the dynamical Lorentz gas. But the inert Lorentz gas is just the usual Lorentz gas in which a particle bounces off scatterers that are fixed in space, and that in this case they are disks. We've seen various generalizations in this conference already. And so, I call a dynamical Lorentz gas sort of the same thing, but in which the disks have an internal degree of freedom that with which the particle interacts in a Hamiltonian way. And so I made a picture under there. You can think of it as a pinball machine in which each of these disks sort of squiggles about. And so when the particle hits it, there will be an exchange of energy. This is not quite what I'll do in a second, but that's what you can have in mind. And of course, the models where these things rotate are of that type too, except that I will not have them rotate, but I will have them behave like harmonic or anharmonic oscillators. So is this going the right way? Yes, yes. So the question I want to, so the question you can ask here, so you can ask questions about behavior of this array of oscillators. That's not what I will do. I will study the motion of the particle. And so I already mentioned that we have done work on the case where you apply an external field, but that's not what I'll do today. I'll talk about this first part here. Here. Return or approach to equilibrium. So there will be just this lattice of oscillators. The particle will move around it, in it, and I want to understand in which way the repeated scattering events the particle undergoes drive its momentum distribution to a Maxwellian. So there have been many talks here, of course, in which in one way or another it was said, well, the particle bounces off a wall or it bounces off an obstacle, and when it comes back off, it is in a Maxwellian distribution. So I'm asking the question before that, how does that happen? Okay. I'm sort of a newcomer to statistical mechanics, and I've learned that this was happening when I was a young kid, and I never understood, and so finally I sort of looking into this question a little more in detail. Now, in another way to put it is, how does Hamiltonian mechanics drive a system to equilibrium? That's to thermal equilibrium. So that's the question I want to address. And so you have seen a picture of the system. It's here, right? The piston on the bottom here. But now I'll give you the Hamiltonian. And so this is a very dense slide, so we'll look at it slowly. It's all very simple, but it takes a little time to get used to it, maybe. So we have a Hamiltonian with the particle has momentum p, and there's a bunch of harmonic or anharmonic oscillators with Hamiltonian capital P n squared over 2m plus u of q n that are sitting at sides that I called x n. Think of it just as a lattice. And so these two terms are just the free system. The particle doesn't interact if I only have these two, with the oscillators, if I only have these two terms. And the oscillators here, they don't interact among themselves, okay? They're just sitting there, bobbing up and down. This is very much like in the rotor model. And then this is the coupling term. So we have to stare at this a little bit. So this is, of course, the coupling constant alpha. The function eta of q tells you how the coupling strength, really, I think of it as a coupling strength. A typical example is eta of q is equal to q. That means that, yes, okay, let me talk about the last term. And the last term is a sigma of y minus x, so y is the position of the particle. So the particle has degrees of freedom y and p, moves in Rd. And when it's close to the scattering center at xn, it sees this potential eta times sigma. Okay? And so this potential is compactly supported. That must be written here somewhere, there. It's compactly supported, and it's rotationally invariant, and it's supported in a ball of radius a half. And these scatterers are at least a distance one apart, so this is really, the particle can pass in between them, and it never interacts with two at a time. Okay? So it's very much, that's how it works. So I think I said more or less everything that's essential on this slide. Let me just say this. So this potential that determines the free dynamics of the obstacle is u of q, and a typical example is, of course, u of q equal q squared, which is, in this case, it's a harmonic oscillator, but it could be another power like this morning, and then it could be an anharmonic oscillator. Actually, in my talk, I will use the word oscillator. It could be harmonic or anharmonic. Sometimes I will say obstacle, and sometimes I will say scatterer, and these are all the same things. They're just one of these terms, okay? So that's, and then the coupling, typically one example is eta of q equal q, but it could be some power also, which has to be smaller than the power of the potential u, which is sort of reasonable because you expect the coupling term to be smaller than the actual term that determines the potential here, the confining potential of the oscillator. So that's the model in terms of the Hamiltonian. And so now I will do something that I hope will impress you, because look at this. I will leave that slide up there because then we have all the notations. So I learned something in this conference here. So this is the Hamiltonian, and there is the dynamics again in a picture. So it's a one-dimensional picture, and so you should think of the particles moving about on a line here. Here's a particle, it moves on the line. It meets this oscillator that's bobbing up and down. So in this case, you should imagine that, think of eta q equal q, and sigma is flat. It's equal to zero outside this region and one there. So when the particle arrives, it sees this potential. Either it has enough energy to hop on, in which case it will travel on like this, with less energy. But then when it's on there, it pushes on the oscillator, right? It interacts with the oscillator. The oscillator notices the particle is there. And then so it will cross, and by the time it crosses, actually, arrives there, the oscillator could be down, and it maybe it can't get out. Then it will rattle around for a while, and then it will jump out, or maybe it cannot get out immediately. Anyway, that's the motion. It's fully Hamiltonian system, okay? And so the particle will go along this line back and forth. Okay, there's nothing else to say about that, I think. Okay, so here's another picture of the motion, in this case of a simulation. So here you have a two-dimensional array, hexagonal array of such obstacles, and a piece of a trajectory with a rather high-speed particle. And so it goes across here, these various obstacles, and it bends a little bit, not very much because it's going fast, but with each obstacle it gets bent a little bit. And there, apparently, somehow it couldn't get out Well, here it actually got bent quite a bit, and then it got out on the other side, got again bent quite a bit, and then it went off this way. Okay. And this is actually a piece of this trajectory. You can see the scale here is maybe 6 obstacles across, and here is 3,000 obstacles across. And this is one trajectory. So that's what happens. A fully Hamiltonian system, and the thing just rattles around. And the question is, what happens to the thing? And so, in particular, let me see. No, it's not the right button. Here we go. Okay, so I said I wanted to talk about approach to equilibrium. Okay, I'm going to concentrate on the momentum distribution of this particle. And so let me just say a few more words. I have to say something about the initial conditions. Okay, so the usual setup, of course. I have a phase space, which I wrote down there, which is the particle position and momentum. Then all the positions and momenta of the oscillators, which I collected together in a big space, omega. The dynamics is the Hamiltonian flow of this Hamiltonian. And I have an initial condition, which is some probability measure on this omega, which I wrote down. You should think of starting all the particles at the origin or in some distribution very close to the origin. That's the delta zero of y. You should think of putting the initial position, the initial momentum of the particle in some distribution, which I called rho zero, which you can also think of as being concentrated around some fixed value. And then all these oscillators are in the same distribution, which I wrote down like that, which is an invariant distribution for the free oscillator dynamics. But they're all in the same and they're independent. That's how I start a system at time zero, and then I run it. And the question I'm asked, so then my position and momentum of the particle are now random variables on this space, and I want their distribution when t tends to infinity. The usual setup, right? So that's the question, and here's the answer. So this is the answer of which I hope to convince all reasonable people by the end of this talk, but not the stubborn ones. Okay? For those who were here in the first talk, they know what I'm talking about. So I claim that if you wait long enough, this particle will equilibrate in the following sense. The probability of finding at large times the momentum in some set A is given by the usual Maxwellian distribution at temperature T. Okay. Now, somebody should ask a question now, because... Say again? Now, this is little O of alpha. Alpha is there. That's the coupling constant. So the statement here is that the limit exists, and that if I take the idea is that the limiting measure exists, and that it depends on alpha, and if I take alpha to zero, I pick up this term. Okay. But of course, first of all, you should be asking me what the temperature is, because I didn't put any temperature in. I didn't say that the oscillators were in thermal equilibrium; they are just in some distribution. Okay. I didn't say that I put them in a thermal bath. I said that I picked some invariant measure for each of the oscillators, the same for all of them. And I say that when this thing rattles around for a while, it will be in thermal equilibrium. Okay, so I didn't put it in, but it just come out. So the question is, what is the temperature? And the answer is this. Okay? The answer is this. And now you have to stare at it for a while to get used to it, I guess. This temperature is defined by this equality here, and the bar here is the average with respect to the given initial measure. And what am I averaging? Well, I'm measuring if you take it some, forget it, if eta q equal q, the linear case which I had up here, then eta prime is not there, then eta prime equals to 1. And then the temperature is given by the average kinetic energy of the oscillator. But if eta q is not equal to q, but equal to q to the second, for example, then you get some coupling weighted average. This is a new average. So the temperature depends on the coupling. Okay. And so that's, we call this a generalized equipartition relation, in the sense that it's not the usual equipartition between the oscillators and the particle at this stage, because there is a slight variation. Okay. So that's the statement of which I have to convince you that is true. And again, I insist on the fact that the Maxwellian comes out, and I didn't put it in. Okay. To measure the initial measure, basically, all these oscillators up there, They have the same initial. Yes.
So we started
in
the zero velocity of the oscillator. The temperature would be zero.
No, because it's no. This is at positive and even at this is at positive temperature.
No, but it finds the temperature in terms of the initial distribution of the oscillator.
Yes, but
you could have started in the zero initial.
No, I can't do that.
Why not?
Because I didn't say all the conditions on rho hat there. But basically, the distribution has to be somewhat reasonable. So let's say it has to be absolutely continuous. It doesn't really have to be. But and it's a result at high temperatures. You'll see why later. But I won't give systematically all the conditions. But it's a good question. Oops. You should think here of rho hat is a distribution just in a two-dimensional phase space, right? Up. And think of it as being concentrated at high temperature, at high energy, sorry. It depends what you call zero temperature, actually. It's a little more delicate than that. Zero temperature is not everybody. Zero temperature is actually one particle on top of one oscillator in the ground state of the combined system. That's zero temperature. No, no, I don't have any potential energy.
You do,
where did you say?
U of Q.
Yes, but if you say zero temperature, then the zero temperature. What did you say?
Right. Initial distribution, zero momentum, but
okay.
Finite energy for U of Q, and you would get a zero temperature from your definition.
No, that doesn't work because it has to be invariant under the free dynamics. You can't put them all.
Oh, invariant.
Yeah. So you could have put them all at rest, at the origin. I agree, but you can't put them all with the oscillators all extended with the same distance. And then release them all together. That's not allowed. It has to be invariant. That's written here. It's encoded there. It's a little bit hidden. Okay? And on top of that, so I give an initial piece of information, although there won't be a proof, complete proof, I'll comment on it. But if this is going to be true in a proof, then T will have to be large. But the claim is that it's true even at low temperature, but I have even less idea of a proof. So that's the statement. What I'd like you to be surprised about, and you can tell me if you are or not, but I repeat, the oscillators are not in equilibrium, and they drive the particle to equilibrium nevertheless. Okay. So now the first part of me trying to convince you will be some numerical data. Okay. And so let's have a look at some of these numerical results. So in this case, we took harmonic oscillators. Ordinary harmonic oscillator. And we took linear coupling. That's sort of the standard model, the easiest model to look at. Okay. And this dotted vertical line indicates that at time t equals zero, all the particles have the same initial speed, 4. That's what this dotted line means. And here is written somewhere t is 10 to the second. So after 10 to the second, t equals 10 to the second units of time, the distribution has spread a little bit like this around. This in it, that's no surprise. The particle starts moving, it gets banged about. Okay. You wait a little longer, 10 to the third, it starts to look like that. And you wait till 10 to the fifth, and it looks like that. Okay, fine, it looks like that, that's fine. But if you look carefully, you see a solid line drawn through this histogram. And the solid line is corresponds to the Maxwellian with temperature, with the corresponding temperature. Okay. But here, I put initially the oscillators in a thermal state. So I call this return to equilibrium. This is what you sort of expect anyway. You put all the oscillators in thermal equilibrium, and I put temperature equal to KBT equal to 2. And at the end, the particles do what they are supposed to do. They're all in equilibrium. Everybody's happy, and nobody's surprised. Now, in the second slide, what is happening is the same dynamical system up there. But this time we put, and this is an example of what you were asking about, Professor Lebovich, we put the oscillators equidistributed on the circle p squared plus q squared equal 2. We draw them just from that circle. So they're not at all, they're not in the microcanonical ensemble of the global system, and they're not in the canonical ensemble, they're just each of them in their own microcanonical ensemble. And you get the thing going, and you see, I don't have to comment really, you see the same thing happening. With the same temperature, final temperature, because the formula for the temperature, this is this equipartition relation. Since in this case I took eta q equal q, eta prime q isn't there, and we are not, it's equal, it's usually equipartition. So now the third slide, we are going to use something else, we're going to use quadratic coupling. So here we put the q squared. Okay, so now it's still a bunch of harmonic oscillators. When the particle hops onto the oscillator, it actually changes the frequency of the oscillator rather than displacing its equilibrium position. And you see the same thing, and don't ask me if we studied that here. We did not. But you see the same thing. After 10 to the 5 units of time, you have a perfectly nice Maxwellian with the same temperature. With the same temperature, why? Because you say, well, I was saying that it might have been a different one, but it won't. Because here, now eta prime is equal to q. So eta prime q squared is q squared. So this is the average of q squared p squared divided by the average of q squared. But since the oscillators are initially in the thermal distribution, this factorizes and the q drops out. So I got again, three times now, the same temperature out. But I want to illustrate that this can give a different temperature in the last example, and I have to make sure. This is the third, and this is the last. So you should just see the difference. The limiting temperature here is 2, and here is 1. Okay? So it equilibrates, again, I just don't have to make the comments, I think. You start the same way, you wait a while. It's a nice Maxwellian distribution. But with a different temperature than before, it's one half the temperature you would expect from ordinary equidistribution. And it's the temperature predicted by that formula that I have in red. Okay, so that's the first part of me trying to convince you that what I claim it seems to be happening. Okay? So now the second part is trying to give you a few arguments which show that this is indeed happening. Okay? And I'm looking, I have plenty of time, right? I mean, that's fine, yeah. Let's see, I think I have said all of this. Yeah, I said all of this, so we can just go to the next slide. So what's happening? Well, we've seen this, of course, before. It's the same in, I think I counted in 20 of the talks that have been given so far, 15 have talked about the same model or some variation. You have a particle moving around, it goes on a straight line, finds some scatterer, bumps around, gets out and gets going again, and that's happening in 15 out of the 20 talks we've seen. So these are all, we are all talking about the same model or some variation thereof. So if you want to sort of analyze how it's happening, there's of course two stages to this process. There is the traveling on a straight line part, finding your next obstacle, and there is the scattering of the obstacle part. And so I call the first part the geometric part and the second part the dynamic part or the Hamiltonian part or something. Right? Because I would treat the second part deterministically. And so you can make it schematic like this. So this is supposed to be one of these disks. This is a particle arriving with initial momentum Pn and impact parameter Bn. So everything is spherically symmetric, so that's going to determine what's happening, together with the fact that this potential on which it arrives moves. So you need to know the initial phase of the oscillator onto which you arrive, and with this data, you can in principle compute your outgoing speed, the position on which you will get out here, and then the next scatterer, and all the rest. Okay, so that's the whole dynamics. And so the first part is what's going to interest me, how you go from Pn to Pn plus 1. Now, so Pn is the incoming velocity here, Pn plus 1 is the outgoing velocity here, which will be, of course, the incoming velocity for the next scatterer. And it's, of course, given, as somebody said, by a theorem of Newton, right? The change in momentum is the integral of the force, right? So, and it's written here. So I wrote the whole thing down again, because I didn't know I would be able to have it there. But so this is the same equations of motion, but now just for one obstacle particle for the particle interacting with one obstacle. So it's a 3-degree a 3-degree of freedom system, if I mind, two dimensions for the particle. They are d plus one dimensional. And so the result here is that Pn plus 1 is Pn plus this thing, where this thing is just the integral of the force. And all you have to do is to integrate this coupled system of differential equations between the oscillator and the particle with the correct initial condition, and you have the new outgoing momentum. And then you get going again. Okay. So this is so and yes, if you believe or want to know why what I said before, this thing here is happening, this here, clearly the only part that matters, sort of, is the dynamical part during the scattering. It's what's happening during the scattering event that's going to change the momentum. After you don't change your momentum. So let's concentrate on that and isolate the random walk in momentum from the rest. And that's, of course, where you cheat, because you bring in a Markovian approximation by saying that when you reach a new scatterer, you act as if, first of all, you haven't been there before, which is okay if you go in high enough dimension. And on top of that, I will explain what I do. So all I will do is study this random walk. It's exactly the same thing, but now the impact parameters, which were here, right? I will simply assume that they are uniform distribution between minus 1 and 1 in two dimensions, or on the unit disk in higher dimensions. And actually, we checked that numerically. That worked very well. And I also assume that they're independent, and that works very well. They decrease. The correlations between these things decrease very fast. So we will just do that. So that's the part about the impact parameters. And we will suppose that when you arrive on an oscillator, you arrive on the oscillator, right? It's like Einstein riding a light ray. We're just going to ride a particle. You come to an oscillator, and what's going to happen to you will depend on the phase of the oscillator, the QNPN, when you arrive. So you draw that when you arrive. And then you get going. And so you have to, again, solve this problem here, which is, again, the same problem as I had before. So this is now a well-defined Markov process. Okay. It's explicit modulo the integration of a differential equation, which is an easy thing to do, as everybody knows, right? So let's try to see if we can understand something. Now, let me try to understand what happens to fast particles. Okay? Well, let's look at the... I will not do the whole momentum business. I will just try to understand what happens to the energy, because it's even longer to explain the momentum part. I'll just look at the energy changes. And so the energy change is, of course, just this thing here, P plus R PK kappa squared minus P squared, where kappa, didn't I write that down on the previous slide? Maybe I'll write it down here. I write the letter kappa is used to indicate the impact parameter and the phase of the oscillator. So kappa N is the impact parameter and the phase of the oscillator at the end collision. And I draw this independently each time I get there. So that's the kappa fitting up there. So, of course, when the particle is going fast, we saw that in the one image I had there, this potential sigma is bounded. And so if it's going very fast, the particle, it will hardly be touched by this one scattering. So it's a weak scattering type of situation, a weak interaction type of situation. So you can expect to expand this entire power of 1 over p, 1 over the incoming speed. And so what you have to do is to compute these coefficients to understand the large speed behavior of this random walk. And so these first two lines are very easy. This is, you do a little perturbative computation, and you find the first two components. The first one is 0. That is a remnant of energy conservation, really. Energy is not conserved, but it's almost. Otherwise, there would be a term in p to the 0 here. The first order term is not nasty, right? It looks, there's the eta prime q, there's the alpha, there's the p over m, and there's a geometric factor which is written here, which has just to do with an integral over along a straight line. It is not very important. The second order term looks like this. It's, again, it's half a page computation. You get this thing. There's a term in alpha, there's a term in alpha squared. The third term, so you can easily compute the average of the second order term and the average of the square of the first order term. You get these very simple things. And the first thing to notice is that this average here is negative. So I'll say it on the next slide. Maybe I'll show it right now. Well, I'll try to explain it here. So if you just write down the first and the second term, you have a fluctuating term in beta 1 here, which has, did I write that the mean was 0? Yes, it's written there. The mean of the first term is 0. So I have a first term which has mean 0 and a second term which is negative. So the second term acts as a friction term. But both are small. The first term is 1 over p and the second one is 1 over p squared. The third order term is on average 0. And the fourth order term has this shape. Now, these two lines are very easy to compute. This one line, it took us about 15 pages, really. It's a very painful computation. And there must be maybe a much more intelligent way to do this. But this term... This doesn't work anymore. Yes, it does. So this term is on average 0, and the fourth order term has this funny form. So let's just stop the computation there. Look at the first terms, and what does this become here? Well, if I now write En plus 1 in terms of En, I get these terms. I keep the dominant term, the dominant fluctuating term. I take the subdominant term, I keep only the non-fluctuating part because the fluctuating part of it is much smaller than the fluctuating part of that one. And of the third order term, I don't keep anything because it's of average 0. And the fourth term, I keep this because it's there. Yeah. And we'll see afterwards why it was okay not to keep the other ones and why I needed this one. So this is the random walk. This is an ordinary random walk on the half line now. So this is a particle, this is a positive energy thing. And to understand its behavior, the easiest thing is to do, because if you have a random walk and you want to know if it converges, if it has an invariant measure, it can be difficult to see. But if you transform it into a stochastic differential equation, it becomes free. So if you take the weak coupling limit on this thing, because you can notice that this is proportional to alpha and this to alpha squared, the weak coupling limit is completely natural, then this converges to a stochastic process in tau, which satisfies this very simple stochastic differential equation in which sigma and gamma are given by these things. So the analysis of the scattering transformation here gives you immediately gives you all the information you need to understand this random walk, basically, at least in the weak coupling limit. So since the corresponding Fokker-Planck equation of this thing is that, you can easily compute now, I repeated the things, its stationary distribution, and it turns out to be exactly what you expect it to be, what you want it to be, I should say. Now, why does this work? Because when you take this equation here, it's, of course, a one-line exercise to find the invariant distribution. You put it equals 0, you compute it. And we saw this morning even, I think. And this is the formula in general. Now, if you want this to be of the form e to the minus beta e, then gamma over sigma squared has to be a constant. Well, and this is the case, because gamma over sigma squared, the dominant term, is a constant. And now you see why, okay, the dominant term was a constant, and there's this subdominant term here. That will produce a term in 1 over e, and when you integrate it, it spits out this prefactor. And it's exactly the prefactor you need to be able to claim that this is a Maxwellian, because it's exactly doing what it, I mean, if you go to momentum space, you need this extra Jacobian to come out. So that's why I kept this last term here, because otherwise I would have only had the tail and not the correct Jacobian, so to speak. And it's also clear now why it's so important that where is this written? That beta 3 is 0 on average, because if it wasn't, I would have a term in beta 3 over 2 e to the 3 halves there, and then here I would have a correction term in the exponent, and it's not there. So this works out just fine. So what's happening here is it's a phenomenon, we baptized the dynamical friction after a paper by Chandrasekhar in 1948. Chandrasekhar actually studied, I don't know how well known this particular paper of Chandrasekhar is, but he studied the motion of stars in a galactic cluster, and he wanted to know the lifetime of a galactic cluster, and he treated the stars as a gas, and he said, well, they're bouncing off each other, so it's sort of a random process, and they should diffuse to higher energies because they get banged about. Now he computed how long the galactic cluster could live, and he figured out it was not long enough with respect to the known data. So he said, well, there must be something in Hamiltonian dynamics that slows it down. And so he computed this, and he got, then he computed this, sort of computed it, or argued that there was indeed this friction term. And so something very similar is happening in this model here. And so we picked up this term, dynamical friction. There is a friction term which is really due to the environment and to the repeated scattering, and it is independent of the nature of the distribution of the scatterers. You scatter a particle of any distribution of oscillators which has this property of being invariant under the local under the local dynamics, it will always end up in equilibrium. And the importance of the fact that it was invariant, you can see here. I should have written it in a different way, but if you average this quantity, you see beta 2 has a term in alpha and in alpha squared. The term in alpha has no sign, and it's very nasty because I will divide it by a term in alpha squared at the end. So I don't want it to be there. And it turns out that the average of this thing is zero in any invariant distribution of the oscillator. And so you need this to be zero. This is why you can't do what Professor Leibovitz suggested to do earlier. You cannot put them all in a state which is not an invariant state. So that's the first part, and then I have a few minutes, actually I have plenty of time. So that explains the data I gave, and but we could talk, part of this you can clearly make rigorous, part of it is harder, but we can talk about that afterwards if you wish. Let me just say that we also studied the spatial motion of this thing. And so now you go back to your random walk. Here's the random walk in momentum space, which we now have more or less completely understood. And now we look at what happens. This random walk in momentum space drives a random walk in time, obviously, in an obvious way. We've seen this several times also in this conference. And it drives a random walk in space. This you have to argue a little bit, but well, it's sort of obvious. I mean, when you get out, you go straight, and you go straight over an average distance, which I called L star, and so then you scatter again, and you go off in a different direction, and you keep going like that. And of course, well, if you analyze this random walk, you will see that the particle turns very slowly. Actually, it is normal because it scatters very little. But when you analyze how it turns, you see it does end up going in a diffusive manner, and you can compute the diffusion constant, and the temperature depends on the diffusion constant. Temperature in the same sense I said before. So when you do that, you find this, where you find that the temperature depends, that the diffusion constant depends like T to the nu on the temperature, and you can compute this nu depends only on two parameters in this whole mess here. Namely, and this is a little bit like this morning, it depends on the strength of the anharmonicity here, which is R, because I call this is uq equal q to the R. And it depends on the strength of the coupling in the sense of strength in the sense of q to the R prime. Okay. So you can see, for example, we did here data with, it should be written somewhere, I hope. This is both with the harmonic oscillator, so R equals 2. I should point there, R equals 2. And one with R prime equal to 1. That's a linear coupling, so 5 halves minus 1, is that it? That gives you 3 halves, and here's the graph. Right? So we run this thing for different temperatures and looked at the diffusion constant, and that's the result. And then if you try quadratic coupling, you get 5 halves minus 2, you get 1 half, and you get this. So you can get a variety of diffusive behaviors, temperature dependence, depending on how tight, let's say, how tight these oscillators are bound to the center and how strongly the particle is coupled to the oscillator, strong in the sense of this here, large R prime or small R prime. Okay. Say it again?
The line.
No, these dots are, as you imagine, the result of... and then you take the function t to the 1/2, and you put a constant in front of it, and you slide it till it fits. Yeah, you fit the constant. So, well, yeah. I hope you find this convincing. That's what it is, yeah. So you get, okay, so, and I think, that, so I think I'm finished, and we'll see. Yes? Yes, okay. I'm finished, but I'll give a little... No, I'm not completely finished, but look, because I'm making some publicity here. See, the dynamical Lorentz gas, a great model to test your favorite conjectures. Okay. On what? On the role, on equilibrium or non-equilibrium statistical mechanics, on the role of chaos, microscopic chaos, on macroscopic or thermodynamic properties, on shadowing, that's because I talked in some other conference one day, on coarse graining, dimensional reduction, and much more. It's easy to use, readily adapted to your needs. It's the model you've been waiting for. Just don't forget to cite us. That's it.